From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Whitmer rolls out her first budget. What are her hopes for fiscal year 2020?
This budget represents our best opportunity to forge a new path here in Michigan.
Building connections between Michigan's Jewish and Muslim communities.
There seems to be an understanding of how people can coexist within the same space without antagonism, without necessarily what is happening overseas being translated and refracted.
West Michigan band Strapping Owls with its funky tuba.
Kind of a rough, raw, bluesy, funky band. I don't know if I've ever heard anything quite like it.
And celebrating Punchki Day with long lines at Polish bakeries.
Try to get only one dozen and come out with two. That's usually how it works.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This budget represents our best opportunity to forge a new path here in Michigan.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer presented her first budget today, a $60.2 billion plan for fiscal year 2020. That's up 3.6% over this year. It's got new spending on education. It strips away the pension tax enacted by Governor Snyder and pays for that by expanding Michigan's corporate income tax to companies that had been exempt. And as you have likely heard, it raises money to fix the damn roads by phasing in a 45-cent a gallon tax on gasoline.
We can put Michigan on the path to prosperity to help people get ahead and attract more business to Michigan. Or kick the can down the road and watch as our roads get worse, our kids fall further behind, and more communities find problems with their drinking water.
Here to help us break it all down is Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News and Michigan Radio's political analyst, Zoe Clark. So a governor's first budget, it really is the best shot at making big changes, isn't it, Zach?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, you've got the momentum that you earned in winning election the previous cycle. What is it that everybody sort of gravitates toward? It's the new, the different. And unlike, at the end of a governor's term where you're pretty much steady as she goes, this is a governor's best opportunity to say, this is what I was elected to do, work with me.
Did she accomplish the goal of trying to say I'm addressing my campaign promises?
Well, sure, absolutely. And, you know, what she had talked about as candidate Whitmer is also what she's talking about as Governor Whitmer. Did she talk about per pupil funding and schools? Check. Did she talk about infrastructure? Check. And did she talk quite a bit about fixing the damn roads? Check, check, and check.
All right. Well, let's start with schools, Zach. Tell us, what is there, first of all, for K through 12?
Well, you've got, I believe, an increase of about $507 million. This would translate to a reasonable, not gigantic, but decent increase in the basic per pupil amount. This is the grant that the state gives to school districts to fund their basic operations. I don't know that it's an amount that's going to, blow anyone away, but I think what the governor is hoping is that increases she's stacking on top of that for special education students and at-risk students will really start to tilt the school funding formula more toward the actual costs of educating students. As a number of experts have said, is necessary that the way the formula works now is sort of one size fits all. And so, for districts that have students that have greater needs, there's going to be a fair amount more money than they're getting now.
And there was this interesting moment, right, when Budget Director Chris Kolb, a former rep from Ann Arbor, actually was talking about that and brought his own personal story, saying that he was a kid that needed more help in school and that he believes that if in his school district he hadn't had, there was not the money, he would not be where he is today. I thought that was a really interesting moment.
And what about higher ed and cyber schools, Zach?
Well, on higher education, the governor has proposed a 3% increase in state aid to the state's 15 public universities. That's on average. I don't believe it's equal amount for each school. I would think that the universities will be fairly pleased with that, given that they have been struggling to get back to where they were prior to the big cuts of the 2011-2012 fiscal year. Cyber schools, Governor Whitmer is trying something that Governor Snyder did unsuccessfully, which is to reduce the amount they get per student. These are the charter schools that are done purely online, largely by charter school authorizing entities, but also some school regular school districts have them as well. The theory being that you don't have the brick and mortar transportation costs that a standard school district has, so why should a cyber charter school get the same amount of money that a brick and mortar charter or brick and mortar traditional public school gets?
Okay, Zach, and give us the sense of, broadly speaking, what's the budget got for clean water?
Well, there's quite a bit of money in there to deal with things like lead service line replacement. There's money for PFAS abatement. There's definitely, I think they're putting in $120 million in a supplemental appropriation for the current year on clean drinking water. Basically looking at the kinds of things we've been talking about for several years now, which is lead service lines, dealing with lead fixtures in schools by instead paying for hydration stations so that kids won't have to use ancient drinking fountains that might have lead components.
Zoe, Governor Whitmer is calling for some targeted tax relief, starting mm-hmm. with doubling the earned income tax credit from 6 to 12%. Remind us what that is and what it means to lower income working people.
Sure. Known as the EITC, it's the earned income tax credit. It's for working families. It was cut, as you mentioned, where it was cut to 6%, again, as Zach is talking about, during the years under Snyder and a Republican legislature. Interestingly enough, just last week, Democratic State Senator Jeff Irwin introduced legislation that would increase it again. So again, really targeted tax breaks for working families here in Michigan. And it means they get some more money back from their taxes.
And retirees will be happy with the word she wants to repeal the pension tax.
Well, and that was another thing that she has talked about for a while. And again, as Zach and I think, Zach, right, we were talking about this last week, that over and over again, though, what you're hearing is, you know, all of these things that are going to create holes in the budget, right, that are going to mm-hmm. take money. And so then again, the question is, how do you put money in the budget to be able to pay for all these, like the pension tax repeal, like more money for schools? And this is really where, I'm going to say it, the rubber hits the road.
Zach, tell us, how does the governor see that happening? How is she going to, where is she going to shift that tax burden from these lower income and retirees?
Well, she wants to pay for the repeal of the pension tax by expanding the way certain types of businesses are taxed. So if a business is formed as a C corporation right now, they pay a 6% corporate income tax. Other entities like LLCs, S corporations, proprietorships, they don't pay that tax. They just pay the same old 4.25% income tax that the rest of us pay. So the idea here is to bring those other entities up to the 6% level. She's calling it parity so that businesses are taxed the same. We've already seen a big pushback from some of the small business groups that this is unfair. And there will be a big fight to stop this.
All right. Now let's get to the one that's caught all the attention. Governor Whitmer says she wants to raise fuel taxes to fix our roads to 45 cents a gallon more at the pump. Stateside's Tyler Scott headed out to see how drivers feel about that.
I hate it. It's stupid. That isn't going to be the answer. You know, and as a retired person, 45 cents a gallon, that's going to kill a lot of trips.
Well, the roads are pretty bad. Really bad. I don't know if that's going to help. Yeah.
I think if it was designated strictly for the road and not rolled into some other general fund, I'd be willing to pay the extra money strictly for roads.
I don't think this should be done by that way. I think it should be done a different way where they do need to be fixed because they're unsafe. I think it should be a different route.
That was Dave Linebaugh, Jennifer Franco, Tom Sletten, and David Norman. Zach, what are your thoughts on this immediate reaction from drivers?
This is a Herculean task. I mean, I hate to use words like dead on arrival because you want to give the governor a chance to make the case for this proposal, but you can already see it from the Republicans who are in the majority. They're not using those words, but they might as well be. And, you know, for motorists out there, this is a huge ask. This would give Michigan far and away the highest gas tax in the country. Now, you can also say, and it's true, Michigan has the worst roads in the country. It is underinvested for years. The governor made this point earlier today that, yes, this is a huge ask. She recognizes that. But they have to get $2.5 billion more per year to bring the roads back up into acceptable condition. And unfortunately, that, you know, you could try some other mechanisms, but they're all going to be pretty painful. One of them is a 45 cent per gallon increase in the gasoline tax. But, you know, what you heard there is exactly the kind of stuff that the governor is going to have to battle, which is people saying things like, find another way, or, you know, hey, I thought the, you know, marijuana money was going to do this, or what about the lottery? I mean, ideas that will simply come nowhere near generating the $2.5 billion is going to test the governor's powers of persuasion to the nth degree.
And Zach, you've seen way more of these budget proposals than I have, but I can't remember the last time that you've actually seen a budget director go through the other possibilities. I thought that was fascinating when Director Kolb is like, or we could do this, or we could do this, but we decided not to. And I just thought, wow, this is the option that we're at, where it's like they're showing what they're going to want to do compared to the other least worst or other worst options. I don't remember seeing that anytime recently. That was fascinating.
Well, it's been an interesting breakdown. We want to thank Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News, as always, and Michigan Radio's political analyst Zoe Clark. We'll have lots more to talk about. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sydney.
Thanks.
Coming up, exploring the Jewish and Muslim communities in Michigan, their histories and their futures.
The Muslim community definitely looks at the example of the Jewish community as a template, similar in size, similar in values, similar in social structure, and as we would perhaps like to go ahead and demonstrate, similar and shared futures.
That conversation after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think of relations between Muslims and Jews in the Middle East, and images of tension, violence spring to mind. But the Jewish and Muslim communities in Metro Detroit work to focus on their similar histories and their shared future. One way they do that is A Shared Future. It's an annual series of community conversations led by Wayne State University professors Howard Lupovich and Saeed Khan. It's the fourth year of the Jewish Community Relations / AJC and the Michigan Muslim Community Council have put on this series. The theme this year, Jewish and Muslim Migration, Histories and Trajectories. Howard Lupovich and Saeed Khan are with us now. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So this lecture series that launches tomorrow is an interfaith dialogue series. And I know that the goal is to build relationships and unite members of the Jewish and Muslim communities in Southeast Michigan. And this issue of the migration, the histories and trajectories is so interesting. And I'm wondering, when did Michigan first become a destination for Jewish and Muslim immigrants, and what attracted them to Michigan? Howard, why don't you go first?
Well, the Jewish community of Michigan, and especially of Detroit, it has a similar history to other Jewish communities around the country, where essentially American Jewry is built on three waves of immigration, each larger than the one before. So there were a handful of Jews who came in the early years of the Republic. There was a larger migration of Jews from Central Europe in the mid-19th century. This second wave was about 250,000 Jews. It was part of a much larger wave of 3 million Jews from Central Europe. And this was the wave of Jews to America who moved west with the westward movement. And this was when most Jewish communities in the Midwest were founded. Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Milwaukee. So the Jewish community of Detroit begins then. But it's after 1880 where the story really gets interesting in a sense where there's a much larger immigration of Jews from Eastern Europe, from Poland and Russia, essentially, and Romania, about 3 million Jews. And this is when the Jewish community of Detroit grows in both in number and in complexity and begins, well, it turns into the Jewish community that it is right now.
And what attracted them to Michigan?
Well, you split that question in two, because apart from the original Jews who came here, if Jews coming to America, if they knew someone in Michigan, friend or relative or a friend of a friend, that would bring them to Detroit or to Michigan. So the real question is, why are those first Jews come here? Usually it was for economic opportunity. I know at the turn of the 20th century, Detroit and especially Mount Clemens had a reputation of being very healthy, sort of the city of the future. So that's what brought these first, is that really economic opportunity and the chance of a good life brought these original Jews. And after that, the Jews who came were mostly Jews who knew somebody who was already here.
And Saeed Khan, kind of track for us the same story for the what brought Muslim immigrants to Michigan.
There's really two different streams of Muslims in the Metro Detroit area. Of course, there's the immigrant community, which you see coming from the former Ottoman Empire, or the so-called Levant. Particularly, we see with organizations forming, the American Muslim Society in the 1930s, also, interestingly enough, a community from the Balkans, Albanians, coming in the 1940s. But of course, there's also here in the Metro Detroit area the added element of what I would call a migration of ideology, and that is among African Americans who embrace the Nation of Islam. One of the very first centers is right here in the Metro Detroit area. Now, as a result of that, that didn't necessarily mean that there was an awful lot of interaction and engagement with these two communities. In fact, they existed in many ways in parallel tracks, the African-American community, and then as there was migration from the Middle East, you find that it builds as Henry Ford, of course, and we know the narrative of hiring people from the Levant. Initially, primarily, it was Arab Christians, but there were some Arab Muslims that came in along with that. Single men who then start to bring their families over. And that serves as a pull factor for more immigration. And Metro Detroit then becomes known as a destination for people who are still in the Middle East.
And when we think about as these new migrants arrived in Southeast Michigan, let's talk a little about where they settled and why. Howard Lubavitch, wasn't the now long gone African-American neighborhood of Black Bottom an early spot for Jewish migrants?
Yes, it's exactly right. That was one of the older Jewish neighborhoods. Really, the trajectory of Jewish neighborhoods in Detroit is a Northwestern movement where they were, as you mentioned, in Black Bottom and 12th Street. Then Dexter, the Dexter area was one of the really the major neighborhoods. And Jews, this is something typical of Jewish immigration and migration, wherever Jews go, they tend to settle near other Jews, partly for reasons, you know, sort of ethnic cohesiveness, but also for communal reasons, to be part of a synagogue, to have access to kosher food, a Jewish school, basic Jewish community life. So there is a series of Jewish neighborhoods. And I can tell you personally, in my own family, my parents grew up in the Dexter neighborhood. My grandparents, they grew up in the Jewish neighborhood before that. You can see that Northwest trajectory.
Absolutely, because from that Dexter-Davison area, then it would be maybe more to Oak Park and to Southfield, moving into Oakland County.
Yeah, after Dexter-Davison, it was Northwest Detroit, the 6 Mile in Livernois, then Oak Park, and then Southfield, and Farmington Hills, and West Bloomfield. And really, you can sort of, when you drive down, let's say from West Bloomfield, you drive south on the Lodge back to Detroit, you're really driving backward in time through the history of the Jewish community in Detroit.
Saeed, what about the immigration track for the Muslim immigrants?
Well, particularly for those who are coming from the Middle East, Dearborn became a destination not because of the allure of Warren Avenue yet, but because simply of proximity to employment. If one were going to be working down at Ford Rouge 1, one wanted to be in walking distance to and from work. Of course, people may not have necessarily had access to buying their own cars. And as a result, around the factory, You see then housing as well as other institutions, mosques, restaurants, stores, which cater to the needs of the community start to develop, and very much like has how he described the Jewish community coming together and congregating. You have that. I think it's really interesting to see that in many ways the factory becomes like a mosque. It becomes sort of the centering feature for a community.
And I'm wondering, as these migrants arrived, how were they received by existing communities?
That's a very good question, and it depends on which community you're talking about. Because I would say, as a rule, Jews would settle in a neighborhood that were, I mean, largely not unoccupied, but they would move into a neighborhood that wasn't full. So there always was a little bit of a backlash. I would say in Detroit, there was no active resistance. The one exception, of course, being that Detroit was the home of probably the two most high-profile anti-Semites in America in the 20s and 30s, Henry Ford and Father Coughlin. But I don't think that really impeded it. The one exception is, one of the reasons that Jews moved northwest out of the city of Detroit and not northeast is the first neighborhood northeast was Hamtramck. Mm. Hamtramck was largely Polish and Ukrainian American. Well, there was some, I would say, some lingering animosity towards Jews among in those communities that they brought over from Eastern Europe. So Jews tended to, in order to avoid those neighbors, they moved northwest. So it's interesting that one of the original Jewish, or several of the original Jewish cemeteries, which were built by Jews in the city, were built northeast of the city in Mount Clemens, because this was before Jews realized they weren't moving northeast. Mm. And as Jews have moved northwest, we live farther and farther away from these cemeteries.
And I should also note, by moving northwest, that also kind of took them away from that 12-mile and Woodward Shrine of the Little Flower congregation of Father Coughlin's, too. So I can see how that fit.
Well, Royal Oak and Berkeley were really never places where, until relatively recently, where a lot of Jews lived.
Yeah. Mm.
I think in the case of Muslims coming to the United States, again, not a nation of Islam, but those coming from the Middle East, they were straddling a racial binary here in the United States. They weren't quite white, but they weren't black either. And as a result, it was more of a matter of navigating that liminal space when it came to issues of race relations, by and large, and especially because they were essentially in an enclave of their own making. One doesn't really see the kinds of racial or animosity that you would to other communities. Now, at the same time, Dearborn had probably one of the most fervent segregationists this side of the Mason-Dixon line, and that, of course, was Mayor Orville Hubbard. And he, of course, had something to say about anybody who wasn't white. But his remarks regarding Arab Americans certainly much more tempered than they were toward African Americans.
That is interesting. As you just joined us, we are talking with Wayne State University professors Saeed Khan and Howard Lupovich, who will be launching a series of community conversations called A Shared Future, bringing the Jewish and Muslim communities in Metro Detroit together, focusing on their similar histories and shared future. And this year's series of conversations explores Jewish and Muslim migration, histories and trajectories. And Saeed, you touched on something I wanted us to dive into, and that is that really fascinating Dearborn hub in this narrative. And as you pointed out, it's legendary Mayor Orville Hubbard, a notorious racist. He was mayor of Dearborn for 36 years, going back to 1942. Certainly, Howard, you pointed out Dearborn's best-known resident, Henry Ford, anti-Semitic. And then now we see Dearborn as the center of this thriving Arab-American and Muslim population. So, Saeed, tell us a little more about how we reconcile Dearborn's past, you know, with the present and got to this inclusive Dearborn of 2019.
Well, numbers and demographics play a very big role in this. And at a certain point, there was the acknowledgement, even by somebody like Hubbard, that there is a community that is productive, that I suppose, to be very cynical, in his mind was also keeping out of Dearborn elements that he objected to having in Dearborn. So it probably wasn't his ideal situation. He probably would have preferred Dearborn to look like Grosse Pointe, but he was going to take what he was going to get. And it's important to see that how the synergy of Dearborn, particularly with the Arab American community being, on the one hand, cohesive and at the same point very thriving when it came to business, put Dearborn on the map in what he would even have to concede is a very positive light. I think that Hubbard would be very conflicted today when people talk about or try to cast aspersions on Dearborn as being a no-go zone and someplace where Sharia is implemented. How ironic that even Hubbard would probably have to push back on that.
It's kind of taking that and moving on and unspooling that a little bit more. That idea of being the other, of discrimination, has dogged these two communities. And I'm wondering how each of you would characterize the level of that in 2019. Is there more of it, less of it? Is it at a same level? Where are we now, Howard?
Oh, I would think that there is on a nationwide level, a national level, mm-hmm. there's been an uptick in anti-Semitism. There's no question about it. And it has become an issue in the last several decades. There's no question about it. How that translates into Detroit or Michigan specifically, I'm not sure. I'm not sure you can see that much specific. And I think, not to toot the horn of Wayne overly much, but I think Wayne State is in some ways an interesting microcosm of the city of Detroit itself, where at Wayne there's a large Muslim community and there's very little in the way of, for example, anti-Israel agitation, which is a source of what's often referred to as the anti-Semitism of the left. And I think this reflects something larger about the city of Detroit, where in Detroit you have a large Jewish community that's lived alongside a large Muslim community, both of which have been six figures for a long time, and there's really been no incident. I mean, and that's something I think pretty distinct. Both those examples, Wayne versus other college campuses and the city of Detroit versus other places where you have Jews and Muslims together, I find it very encouraging.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of this has to do with a word that often isn't used regarding demographic groups, especially migrant groups. Everyone talks about assimilation. I would say that this is acclimation. The fact that Muslims and Jews in the Metro Detroit area are clearly not ambivalent. They don't just simply shrug their shoulders and walk by one another. But I think that there's an acclimation that seeing somebody who's Jewish, particularly here on Wayne State's campus, is not seen as a shock. Seeing somebody wearing a yarmulke is not a shock. There seems to be an understanding of how people can coexist within the same space without antagonism, without necessarily what is happening overseas being translated and refracted into an obligation of these communities to then be antagonistic to one another here.
And I would add that on this campus, and I think in the city in general, is yes, we have discussion, debate, but we do it constructively and in a civil way. The whole, when people speak about the decline of civil discourse, not here.
That is something that leaders in the Jewish and the Muslim communities and other faith communities have really worked on a long time. I can remember when the Persian Gulf War broke out in the early 90s, being sent to cover a very, very pronounced effort. You had faith leaders from every tradition standing together. So to see an imam standing next to a rabbi and saying, we can come together, we can't let this divide us. And it seems like there really has been a lot of hard work put in over the decades by community leaders.
I agree. And I think it's a symptom of the fact that the Jewish and Muslim communities here are not only well organized, they have a sense of confidence and security enough to be nuanced. And to understand, to avoid black-white, you know, to embrace gray area issues in a way which has a certain subtlety and in a productive and constructive way.
Yeah, these are communities that certainly don't put their heads in the sand, quite well aware of what's going on in other parts of the world and the fluidity of those situations. But they also are savvy enough to recognize that the optics may not necessarily be conducive to this day and age of social media and the wow factor. I like to oftentimes say that even if they're not working on bridges, they're working in the tunnels. And so there's always an activity, there's always an engagement. Nobody walks away from interacting with one another.
What do you hope people will take away when they come to the series of three community conversations you will be holding as part of this A Shared Future? What do you want people to take away from that, Howard?
I'm hoping people will see first and foremost in the subject of Jewish migration or immigration to America and the whole immigration experience, that there are these striking parallels between the immigration experience of Muslims and Jews if you allow for a time lag of about 80 years. So a lot of the discourse about Muslim immigration right now is very similar to the discourse about Jewish immigration in the 1920s. And from that, I'm hoping Jews who come to these will come away with a certain empathy, if they don't already have it, for the whole the situation of Muslims in this immigration debate, and that Muslims will maybe be able to, that there'll be some takeaway, learn some lessons for how Jews dealt with some very similar challenges back in the 1920s.
Saeed Khan, last word goes to you.
Oh, I would definitely agree with Howie. And in fact, I would add to that by saying that the Muslim community definitely looks at the example of the Jewish community as a template, similar in size, similar in values, similar in social structure, and as we would perhaps like to go ahead and demonstrate, similar and shared futures.
Wayne State University Professor Saeed Khan and Howard Lupovich, who will be giving the fourth annual lecture series, A Shared Future, an interfaith dialogue that kicks off on Wednesday by the Jewish Community Relations Council /AJC and the Michigan Muslim Community Council. It was great talking to both of you. Thank you so very much. I'm sure these are going to be great sessions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Up next, new music from West Michigan, and we will celebrate Fat Tuesday with Punchki.
Try to get only one dozen and come out with two. That's usually how it works.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to check out music from West Michigan as we say hello again to John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com. And John, here we are, Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras celebrations wrapping up today in New Orleans, and you are starting us out with a Michigan band who just played in the Big Easy?
Absolutely. They were on tour behind their brand new album called Live Wire Soul, and I thought it was appropriate. We're talking about the Strapping Owls, which is led by a Fenville musician by the name of Fred Boltman. And if you imagine a funky blues power trio that features a tuba instead of a bass. And Boltman had been playing bass, but he resurrected his sousaphone. He used to play it in college, and the idea just took off. And he really came up with something unique. And I have to admit, I know a lot of bands that incorporate horns and sousaphones into their approach, but a kind of a rough, raw, bluesy, funky band, I don't know if I've ever heard anything quite like it.
I loved listening to that. And here is that wonderfully funky sousaphone in this great track from their album Live Wire Soul. This is I Wish I Was a Bird. That is so fun. I just love that. And tell us a little more about Fred Boltman, because he's got kind of an interesting backstory.
He certainly does. He's a beer connoisseur. He was once VP of Sales and Marketing at Bell's Brewery in Kalamazoo and a minority owner in Holland's New Holland Brewing. He wrote a couple of books. The one that's the most famous, I think, is The Beer Evangelist. But, of course, he's always been a musician, and he really, this whole idea took off with a couple of friends from Chicago, Nicholas Barron on guitar and vocals, and Larry Beers on drums. And it's just one of those things that I think when people watch them live, that whole tuba just sort of takes the center stage along with the vocals and the really bluesy, raw sound.
Tons of fun, and I know they just wrapped up their tour while they were, by the way, in New Orleans. So no upcoming performance dates, but go to strappingowls.com and you can keep up on their latest schedule. Now we head over to Grand Rapids, Deep Greens and Blues. And I got to tell you, as I listened to the title tune from their third studio album, Roll On, John, I marked out a big heart and a big exclamation point.
Not surprising. This band, I've followed them for about 8 years, and they've always focused very heavily on their harmonies, but their songwriting's really grown as well, and the size of the band has grown a lot. They started kind of as a duo and then really performed for years as a trio. They added a drummer a couple years later. Now they're a six-piece band. They have a fiddler and a lead guitarist. Their recent album release show here in Grand Rapids was jam-packed with people. They have a very country-sounding feel to them, but they also sort of still lean back on their indie folk and alt country kind of approach. And it's interesting because they put it, this is their most musically and emotionally complex collection of songs yet. It's certainly gotten some attention here in Grand Rapids.
There ain't no use in looking behind when the road has the answers that we seek to find. Throw the rearview mirror in the backseat and roll on, roll on. I got a feeling we gotta roll on. Our best days are yet to come. I'm still believing.
And upcoming shows?
They will be performing on March 16th at Elevation in Grand Rapids along with Domestic Problems.
Okay, yeah, you are talking my musical language with a band like Deep Greens and Blues. Now we head over to Political Lizard. I love these band names, by the way. Love, love, love. Tell us about Political Lizard.
So my ears always perk up when I hear other musicians talking about a band or an artist or a local band, or maybe they started listening to a local act that's really gotten their attention. And that's true for the next couple of bands that I'm going to be talking about. Political Lizard is a up-and-coming young duo that has now recently expanded to become a four-piece band. And they've gotten some pretty impressive endorsements from the beginning. For one thing, they toured with Traverse City's The Accidentals, who asked them to join them last summer. And that was an experience that really gave them a head start and really got them kicked to the next level. They finally released their first studio album titled Joy the Dog in early February. It's got a real interesting mix of indie rock, soft pop. Soft rock is the way they describe it as well. And it really is intoxicating. The more you listen to this band, the more you feel like you want to hear more from them.
But if you're counting me out, the fun, 'cause we are separate minds. But if you're counting me out, the fun, in a parking lot, treating whispers for whiskey and full moons for flowers and pot. It's cold when you're not here, and I'm losing touch, 'cause you're in the doorway and I've never felt.
And there are some upcoming dates, right?
Yes, Jenna Olson and Caleb Waldvogel of Rockford and their bandmates will be performing on March 22nd at Rockford Brewing here in the Grand Rapids area, and then at Mustang Junction in Edmore on April 20th.
And then we're going to wind up with a new release from singer-songwriter Jason Singer, better known as Michigander.
Yes, he's familiar to Michigan radio, so there might not be a need to go into great detail about this, but the anthemic pop and indie rock artist continues to make a splash. He just released a new single last week, so I thought we'd wrap up the segment with that update. And he just won 3 Jammy Awards here in Grand Rapids for Best Album by a New Artist for his 2018 release, which was titled appropriately Midland, because that's where he's from, although he recently moved back to Kalamazoo, so once again we can claim him as a West Michigan artist.
And this is the new single, Circles.
So where do we go from here? Feels like I'm running in circles. Where do we go from here? I've been facing all my fears, but I'm running in circles, facing all.
I understand, heading soon to a pretty big spotlight in Texas.
Yes, there are 10 Michigan acts that will be performing at an official showcase in Austin for South by Southwest. Michigan House has been holding showcases down there for the last several years. This will take place on March 11th, and Michigander is part of that. He's also going to be playing March 30th at the Blind Pig with Joe Hertler in Ann Arbor, and April 18th at the Loft in Lansing for the Capital City Film Festival. So you do have an opportunity to here in Michigan to catch him as well. But I think he's going to make a little bit of a name for himself down in Austin, too.
Well, you can learn more about these and all kinds of other artists with West Michigan roots by going to localspins.com, which, of course, is edited and published by John Sinkovich. As always, John, it's been a blast. Thank you.
Happy Fat Tuesday.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And this is indeed Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras in New Orleans, the last day before Ash Wednesday and Lent with all its fasting. In Metro Detroit, this is Punchki Day, the Polish Fat Tuesday. It goes back to the Middle Ages when you'd prepare for Lent by clearing your house and ridding it of lard and sugar and other goodies and make fat little fried donuts filled with sweet jams or creams. And just what possesses people to line up for hours in single-digit temperatures outside their favorite Hamtramck bakery?
Punchies, what else? Every last one of them. All of them.
My name is Kelly, and I live in Warren, Michigan. What brings me out here? I'm out here for Fat Tuesday for Punchki Day to get my punchkis for me and my mom.
All right. My name is Holly Payne. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I came in town with family and can't get a punchki in Anchorage, so I had to come down and get a real one.
My name is Rolf Mack. I live in Waterford, Michigan. You can't beat this punchki. That is why we're standing out. Usually we call them in. We forgot this year. Thus the Arctic wear. Try to get only one dozen and come out with two. That's usually how it works.
And that is so true. And Hamtramck has also produced an interesting twist on the punchek, which is the singular of punchki, and that is booze. Mike Moyanis is co-owner of Smalls. It's the bar and music club on Conant, right in the heart of Hamtramck. He's the creator of the boozy punchki bomb. He joins us now from Smalls, which serves his punchki creation all day. So, Mike, if I line up at one of Hamtramck's bakeries, I'm going to get punchki with fruit and cream fillings. If I come to Smalls, what do I get?
Well, we have a few different flavors. I do custard, raspberry, strawberry, blueberry, and apple. But ours are infused with vanilla vodka.
Vanilla vodka. Now, yep. Where'd this idea come from?
One of the first punchki days we did here, we were kind of bored and sitting around and decided, I wonder how this would taste. And it was a pretty tasty treat, except we had the big punchkis at the time, so it soaked up too much booze. So I've since then made half-size punchkis from a bakery in Royal Oak called Herman's, and they do them perfect for me. So it's more like a two-biter thing. Like you suck out the insides basically with the straw and take two bites, and you get a little booze and sugar in every bite.
All right. So you do. You use a straw to kind of suck out that. How do you get the vodka in?
I inject it. I inject it the night before, and then I top it off when people order them to order.
Just to get a little bit more. So I'm very interested in just how potent these little punchki bombs could be. I guess how many would I have to eat before I'd have to get an Uber?
Well, the dough kind of counteracts it. So it's usually people, you really can't have more than three or four probably. But there's a full shot in each one.
Have you tried any other flavored vodkas?
Yeah, well, we also do, I do raspberry and blueberry, and those go good with, you know, obviously blueberry and raspberry, but they go really good with the custard. We do Yeji if people ask for it, or Bailey's is a good one with the custard. And even you can even do Captain Morgan's with the apple one.
Okay. So really, the sky's the limit as far as being creative.
Yeah, well, we used to let people make their own decisions and do any combination, but when it's so busy, we had to limit it.
Well, and then speaking of busy, how many punchki bombs do you sell in an average punchki season?
55 dozen, usually before 5 o'clock. So like in 7 hours, we'll go through 55 dozen.
And you've been doing this a little while now, right?
Yeah, it's like our 11th year with the punchki bomb.
What were the initial reactions when people, that first year when you said, I'm bored, let's come up with this idea, and they came in and discovered, oh my goodness, I can get a vanilla vodka punschke. What were people saying?
They loved it. We didn't. It's nothing that we planned. Like, we were going to, like, this is going to be our signature thing, but everybody loved it, and then the word started spreading, and people coming in going, what is this punschke bomb? And media got a hold of it a little bit, so that's definitely helped. There's been videos of me and different interviews I've done over the years that keep popping up every season. So it's great when you get to see me from 11 years ago, how much I've aged. But
that's all those punschke bombs you've been having. So.
Right.
Well, Mike Moyanis of Smalls in Hamtramck, the creator of the punschke bomb. So you can go there to Conant and have yourself a punschke with an extra kick. Hey, thanks for spending time with us on Stateside. Happy Punschke Day.
Happy Punschke Day. Thank you.
Punschke Day. All the tourists come Hamtramck's way. And I add 10 pounds to what I weigh. Oh, I believe in Punschke Day.
There's another Michigan tradition tied to this Punschke Day. For years, Congressman John Dingell and his team would deliver boxes of punschke to friends, a tradition that Congresswoman Debbie Dingell is determined to continue. She is here with us now from Washington. First of all, Congresswoman, I've realized there are people that kind of don't know that John Dingell's grandparents immigrated to the U.S. from Poland. Remind us, what was the family name before it was modified to Dingell?
It was Dinkelvich. So it then went short for Dingell. And John Dingell was always very proud of his Polish heritage.
And when and why did he start connecting this idea of dropping off boxes of punschke?
You know, he has always been proud of his heritage, and he loved punschkes. And I don't know that I was even in the room when he started this. But I know it's gone on for a long time. And, you know, rituals and traditions are important. There's things that connect us generation to generation. So it's a tradition, a ritual that actually started with his family back in Poland. And it's something that we've kept here. And now it probably is more important to me than ever that we keep this tradition going. New Orleans has Mardi Gras. In Michigan, we have punschkes.
You know, I know that through the years, I have seen John Dingell boxes of punschke at different radio stations that I've worked at through the years. And I've kind of always wondered, who gets the treats? Are they Detroit? Are they in D.C.?
Well, I'm doing a lot of people. Yesterday, I delivered them myself to every fire station in Dearborn and the police station to thank every one of the firefighters and the police that have been so good to us over the years and were there for me in the last few weeks for what's been really tough. He has sent them, he gives them to leadership in Washington, Republicans and Democrats. I'm giving them to everybody in the Michigan delegation, my colleagues on the committee, a lot of the media in the area get them as well. It's kind of, how do you make visible this wonderful tradition of his heritage? And you know, in Michigan, we celebrate so many of the different cultures. You know, we're lucky. We celebrate when we all come together. Think about what we have, that we have Italian heritage and Greek heritage and Polish heritage and Lebanese heritage. And we get the best of everybody. And it makes us just think what we get to enjoy as we celebrate everybody's heritage.
Any idea how many boxes of punschke you're going to be delivering this year?
Well, this year it may be over the top.
Go ahead, tell us.
I'm delivering well over several thousand punschkes to people. Because, you know, it's a way of my sort of touching John, being in touch with him and sharing him. So today it's been a hard day, a smile day, and a tough day all at the same time.
And I know you've got lots of punschke helpers, don't you?
I do. I've got friends back home that have been helping me. My staff has been helping me. You know, even the fire and the police were. So I'm blessed. But I have tried this year to deliver as many of them as possible personally.
All right. I have to ask you, what is your favorite filling?
You know, I'm a chocolate girl, I have to say. I mean, I know it's not. I could pretend and say, oh, strawberry. It's healthy. I do chocolate. It's the best.
Well, they are delicious. I will say that I did enjoy a sampling from the box your team delivered here. And I have to thank you for, at the end of your nice letter, you say, happy Punchki Day, enjoy his memory, and don't think about any calories.
No calories. I'll tell you what I want to try. I've heard about it now for a couple of years, and I've got to get to Coney Island to try the Punchki hot dog, the Punchki Coney Island dog. It has to be an interesting taste.
Well, that it does. Right about that. Well, you'll have to report in when you give that a try.
I will next year. That's what I'm going to do next year.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, happy Punchki Day, and thanks for being with
us. Thank you. Thank you. Happy Punchki Day.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Rozzy Joffrey, Katie Raymond, Tyler Scott, and Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.